This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, and we have just finished updating our top 100 prospects list, a little thing we like to call market corrections. We're 6 weeks into the season. We initially set the list back in January. It was time to spruce it up a bit, so we did. And we're going to talk about what changes were made, especially at the top, and some of the biggest risers, some fallers, some new names, new additions to the list. We are also going to talk about some of the latest big league call-ups, a couple of them, Yuri Perez and Matt McClain, a couple of top 100 prospects. We are going to touch on the prospect team of the week, and Matt McClain all over the place, top 100, big league call-up, prospect team of the week. And we're going to talk about some draft buzz, because we are, what, 2 months away from the draft? Less than 2 months? Frightening.
That's crazy.
Frightening. Jim, are you frightened?
No, not frightened at all. I'm very excited. So all good.
Excited.
All good. Excited. Have draft fever.
I should mention that we're gonna wrap up by answering a question from the mailbag, but you knew that. Market corrections. So we started doing this a few years ago. Previously, we put out the preseason top 100 prospects list in January, and then updated it mid-season, right around the trade deadline, after the draft and the signing deadline, so that we get all the new draftees integrated into the list. But a few years ago, we started making some sort of minor adjustments. And why don't one of you guys kind of explain what adjustments are made and how?
Well, the simplest way, we're not trying to redo the whole top 100 from scratch. Like, I mean, I think it's fair to say that if we had the time and manpower to do it, I think MLB.com would be happy if we did that once a week, just because of all the attention it does. But we don't. We're dealing with the draft. We're dealing with a million things. So it's to kind of deal with things that you'd like to update before we get to that massive update at the end of July. So essentially, Sam Dykstra and Jonathan and I reconvene and we vote from scratch for the top 15 prospects. And then after that, we make adjustments, but it has to be a significant adjustment, generally up or down 10 spots to move you out of your original order on the list. I think that's the simplest way to explain it, Jonathan.
Yeah, no, that's it. It's kind of just trying to take into account what's happened so far and an understanding that this is a volatile deal from the get-go. And I think we recognized a couple of years ago that the list gets a little dated, a little static in a hurry. And this is a way to, without doing a full-on re-ranking of all the different lists, sort of recognizing major changes that we feel are worthy of a move up or down.
You know, not, by, for instance, though, saying, hey, we like Royce Lewis more than Edwin Arroyo now, so we're just going to flip those two guys next to each other on the list. It has to be, we want it to be significant and not just, because otherwise you might as well just revote on the whole list from 1 to 100.
Right.
All right, so let's start at the top of the list. There were some changes. Something that did not change was the number one overall prospect. That was Jordan Walker as of just recently, because what, Francisco Alvarez had been number one and graduated from the list. But you guys in whole determined that Walker would retain the number one spot. Next up on the list, Jackson Churio, Jackson Holliday, Ellie De La Cruz, Marcelo Meyer. Churio moved up a couple spots. Holliday, five. Ellie De La Cruz, a couple. Meyer stayed put. He was at five, remains there. So how many of those guys warranted discussion for the number one overall spot?
I would say, the top four. So Walker, Churio, Holliday, and De La Cruz warrant being at least mentioned as in the conversation.
Although it was interesting because all three of us, Sam and Jonathan and I, voted for a different player at number one. You know, Sam voted for Jordan Walker. Jonathan voted for Churio. I voted for Jackson Holliday. None of us had De La Cruz in the top two on our ballots, although I agree with what Jonathan's saying. I mean, yeah. I think he's in that discussion. And, you know, Walker was no lower than two on any of our ballots, whereas I voted Churio fourth, Jonathan voted Holliday fourth, and that's kind of how we separated the tie. But there was... I don't know if we've ever had a vote, Jonathan, for the very top of the top 100, where we've had three people voting and we've picked three different players.
I'd have to go through our very detailed archives and try to sort that out. But I don't know that we have. And I think, you know, an argument could be made for any of the three that we voted for number one. And it wouldn't surprise me if all three ended up number one at some point in time, given where they are, in their development and, you know, what ladder they're at organizationally. Although I do think Jackson Holliday might end up in AA before the year's over, but so I think that makes it interesting.
With Jordan Walker, I mean, he already has about 3 weeks of big league service time as it is. So if he comes back up, he could be replaced, you know, after about another month of big league time. He's at 28 days, so he's really less than 3 weeks away if he gets called back up. I mean, Cardinals are playing well now, so they don't have to scapegoat anybody. So he might stay in the minors a little bit longer.
And the next player on the list is also in the big leagues, Grayson Rodriguez. I expect he'll be coming off the list soon. He dropped three spots from three to six in this ranking, this re-rank. He's followed by Yuri Perez, also just called up. So also in the big leagues. And then James Wood, who jumped five spots from 13 to 8. And Jordan Lawler, number 9, dropped a couple of spots. And Brett Beatty, pretty sizable jump from 17 to 10. And that rounds out the top 10.
And Jason, just to touch on what you said about Rodriguez, it also applies to Brett Beatty, who had some experience last year. Both those guys, unless they get sent down, will graduate off the top 100 before our next podcast next week.
Yeah, so there will be some changes. Some of these guys moving into the top 10 at that point. Evan Carter made the biggest jump of anyone in the top 15. Rangers prospect jumped from 33 to 11. He's followed by Andrew Painter, who had climbed all the way to 2 after, you know, graduations early in the season by players that were ranked ahead of him. But the fact that he's not thrown yet this year after injuring himself in spring training has him at 12. Drew Jones at 13. Diego Cartaya at 14. Jones dropped a couple spots, Cartaya 4. And then Pete Crow Armstrong, another jumper, went from 22 to 15. Jim, another opportunity for you to talk about Evan Carter.
Yeah.
Twist your arm.
As I said, I was going to pound the table for the first market corrections to get Evan Carter moved up. I don't think I really had to pound the table too much because both Sam and Jonathan also like Evan Carter as a prospect. But, I'll replay my greatest hits. I think he might have the best batting eye in the entire minor leagues. He's in AA at age 20. Potential five-tool center fielder, and the power hasn't fully come yet, but I think it will. I think he's going to have solid power when all is said and done. I just this guy's approach at the plate and ability to discern balls and strikes is just so impressive. It's why he continues to move very, very quickly.
Uncle Jim, tell us the one about the time that he almost forgot he got married.
Yeah, no, I did like that one when I interviewed him in spring training.
So I've never heard that story.
I think I've only told
that
twice. Said
no one ever.
I've only told that one twice. Come on, that isn't like comparing Jason Dominguez to – everybody compares him to Mickey Mantle and Bo Jackson and Mike Trout, like which we said probably a dozen times. So
even when we're not talking about
him. Yeah, I haven't worked that one in right now. It's unbelievable.
And Jonathan, one of the guys in the top 15 and top 10 who made one of the bigger jumps, and you know these are all relative to the others, not a huge jump here, but James Wood has now climbed into the top 10 for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, he made, you know, the huge leap last year. Guy with unbelievable tools, you know, going from the Padres to the Nationals. And you know, really put them into use last year in A ball, and I think you know we'd moved him way up because we thought the tools would play, and here he is in High A, and once again the tools are playing. You know, he's got an ops of 930, he's drawing walks. The strikeout rate is still a little high, but if he keeps drawing walks and hit for power and stealed bases, he's got 5 homers and 5 steals over his first 31 games. And he's a really, really exciting, super athletic, 6'6", 240-pound outfielder with just the completely full toolbox. And he's, you know, moving as he moves up the ladder, and he's age 20 for all this year. He's showing that those tools are they're playable. It's not just dreaming on them. He's using them now, and that's, I think, what excites us the most about him.
Okay, let's move down the list a bit and talk about some guys not in the top 15, but the guys who made the biggest jumps on the list. Heading that list is Rays infield prospect Junior Caminero, who jumped 36 spots from 96 to 60. Did not begin the season in the top 100 and is now all the way up to number 60. Zach Neto, just behind him, jumped 35 spots. Angels, now big league infielder, went from 78 to 43. Another guy who is in the big leagues now and has acquitted himself quite nicely there, Bryce Miller. Of the Mariners, jumped 25 spots from 86 to 61. Another Mariner, Cole Young, jumped the equivalent 25 spots. Shortstop prospect jumped from 95 to 70. Evan Carter, who we already mentioned, 22 spots. Dalton Rushing jumped 22 spots. Dodgers catching prospect from 91 to 69. Tanner Bibee, Cade Horton, the other couple who jumped at least 20 spots. Both right-handers, Guardians and Cubs. Junior Caminero, feel like there's a lot of buzz about him right now, and that's reflected here.
No, it is. Not only did he make the biggest jump, I also think if we updated heights and weights, he would make the biggest jump in weight because he is not 157 pounds. That is incorrect, but that's probably what he weighed when he signed. But no, he's – yeah, the Rays, again, I don't know why people trade with the Rays because you get burned a lot.
Hang up the phone.
The Guardians had made a lot of good trades, but this was not one of them. It was classic Rays playbook where they have more prospects than they can possibly protect on the 40-man roster. So in November of 2021, they traded Tobias Myers to the Guardians and got Junior Caminero, who at that point had not played outside of the DSL. He had played very well in the Dominican Summer League. And since coming to the States, all he's done is hit. He's tearing it up this year in High A at age 19. He won't turn 20 until July. He's hitting 367. He's got 1126 ops, 8 home runs already in 27 games. Just a really exciting package of offensive tools. There's bat speed. There's bat-to-ball skills. It's huge exit velocities, the hard contact. He makes it to all fields. He lets the power come naturally. You know, third base is probably the best case scenario. You're hoping he'd become an average third baseman. But he's going to hit enough to play somewhere on the diamond. The bat is going to profile wherever he winds up. And this could be a guy who might be in the big leagues by the time he's 21 years old. He looks tremendous.
I'm all in on the Caminero train. I just think he's really, you know, for all the reasons Jim pointed out, I just, the more and more we hear about him and see the number he's putting up. And, like I said, hang up the phone. If you hear from the Rays asking for a low level player, you should not respond or at least say no.
And Jim, what's the timeline there in terms of when the Rays got him? He hadn't cracked even the Guardians, or I guess Indians at that point, top 30 prospects.
You sure? You're risking $25,000 there.
I feel pretty confident. Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know about when they got him though.
November 21? Like, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
I think they were Guardians by that point.
Oh, man. $25,000.
But yeah, no, risk. I mean, at that point, I mean, it's hard. Like, he played well in the Dominican Summer League. He hit, you know, 295 with some power in the Dominican Summer League. But we generally don't rank a lot of guys in the Dominican Summer League unless either A, you're a top prospect, you know, a guy who is one of the top prospects in your class. Or, you know, to be honest, a case where maybe the system isn't that strong and you're like, geez, I need to add some guys to this list. Here's a guy in the DSL. But, you know, the Guardians have a deep system and he just wasn't, you know, that type of guy. You know, he, you know, had not made his pro debut. It was delayed. You know, he's a guy who, because of the pandemic, he signed in 2019. He lost his season to the pandemic. He just really hadn't played a whole lot. And that's just good scouting by the Rays. I mean, there's a lot of teams that do this now, but it's fair, you know, it's something that's really picked up in the last decade or so, where back in the past, I don't think teams bothered to scout rookie level players that much. But you could see it pay off. I mean, the most famous example, and the guy hadn't even played a game, was Yordan Alvarez, who the Astros really liked but weren't able to sign. The Dodgers signed him, and then they traded for Yordan Alvarez before he made his pro debut. And I think teams have realized, I mean, it's more of a gamble. There's more risk involved because they're further away from the big leagues. But there's potential also bigger payoff when you're making trades, if you're willing to roll the dice on a super young guy you believe in. You know, if a guy's in the DSL and he's, you know, at that level, four, you know, five levels away from the big leagues, Junior Caminero, you could trade for him then a lot easier than you could trade for Junior Caminero today.
All right. Jonathan, you want to talk a little about a player who I think the general baseball fan is probably much more aware of.
they are. I mean, what Bryce Miller has done in the big leagues has just been absolutely astounding. One run over 19 innings. He's walked one and struck out 18. And this is amazing for a guy who people initially, and he was from Jim's neck of the draft. Do I win anything for getting that phrase in the earliest in a podcast? We're not even talking about the draft and I use neck of the draft. But, you know, this is a guy that people weren't sure he was going to be a starter. So talk about good scouting. I mean, the Mariners got him in the fourth round out of Texas A&M after, you know, he had one good turn in the rotation. Well, showed good stuff anyway. And, you know, he competed for the job in spring training, didn't get it. And they sent him back down to Double A just for him to you know, work on some stuff and, you know, pitch well enough there to come back up. And he's just been unbelievable. And it's really all about the fastball. And I guess that's the one thing, like, let's see how sustainable it is. The fastball is ridiculous. But he's been getting a miss rate between Double A and the big leagues, a miss rate of 31% on his fastball. And he throws it a lot. You know, he's got a good slider and he does have a changeup, but neither of them miss bats or is as dominant as that fastball. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, as he gets around the league, whether he makes adjustments or is he just one of these rare cats where, like, the fastball is just so good that that they're never, you know, hitters are just not going to figure it out. If he can command the fastball the way he's been doing it, he's gonna be successful for a long time.
Always funny to me when you get a guy like Miller who, in his first four starts at AA Arkansas this year, was 0-2 with a 6.41 ERA, gave up 23 hits over 19 and two-thirds innings, was getting hit at a 280 clip. And then he goes out and is just nearly unhittable in the big leagues over three games. So,
well, I think what Jonathan was saying, I mean, I think that's a tribute to his fastball command. You know, he wasn't walking guys, but a lot of these guys who have the big carry fastball, I mean, we've talked about it with Jack Leiter. We've talked about it with Ben Joyce, who seems like we've gone several podcasts without mentioning Ben Joyce. It's probably shameful. Longest since last year. These guys who have the big carry fastball, if they don't command it and they leave it over the middle of the plate, or not even the middle of the plate, but if they don't get it up, it gets hit. And I think that's what the case was with Bryce Miller. He was just a little bit off. He was throwing strikes, but he gave up more homers and walks in those four starts. And since he's been in the big leagues, I mean, you look at the highlights, he's putting that fastball where he wants it, and guys just can't catch up to it.
Okay, so we talked about biggest risers. We're not going to go through each of the biggest fallers, but generally speaking, the guys who fell the most, I guess, fall into two categories, guys who have been injured and guys who, I mean, is it as simple as haven't performed this year, or is there generally more to it for the guys who are not injured on the list?
I mean, because again, I mean, we aren't just moving a guy down three spots because, you know, Jason Ratliff's added 2 miles an hour to his fastball.
No, he has.
He's outperforming Jonathan Mayo. No, but I'm saying we wouldn't make that move if it was only two or three spots. It has to be, you have to move down at least 10 spots for us to physically move you down our list. So, yeah, I mean, it comes down to performance.
I'd like to see you guys physically move these players.
Now, we drove to Beloit and moved Jacob Berry down 20 spots.
Like, the way we figured this out is we got all the 100 and then some other, and we lined them up down like the left field line and just shuffled them around. Yeah.
Moved them around.
Kind of scratched our chins and molded over a little bit and said, can you two guys switch? You go down.
That's exactly
10 spots
what we did.
To your right. Yeah. We should take pictures next time, but or video at least. It's a missed opportunity.
A real behind the scenes look at how this is done. I like it. So Jim, you were saying, so the guys who, so Daniel
the first three
Espino,
guys on the list are all injury guys.
Yeah.
It's Daniel Espino's got, I won't tell my Daniel Espino story again, but like shoulder surgery, who knows when he's going to be back. Kate Cavalli had Tommy John surgery. Chase DeLauter re-injured his foot, which he broke last spring, and still has yet to make his pro debut, like maybe sometime in the middle of the season. So the three biggest drops were the injury guys, and then the biggest performance drop was Elijah Green, who still has otherworldly tools, but the last time I checked, his strikeout rate was about 45% in pro ball, which caused us to pump the brakes a little bit.
Yeah, so Espino dropped 50 spots from 12 to 62, and that one really kills me because, Jim, you had me excited with your Daniel Espino story.
Best guy I've ever
seen. You're not
going to
tell.
Yeah, best guy I've ever seen live.
He had a ton of helium and was really anxious to see him. And now we're looking at a scenario where he's dropped from 12 to 62.
Well, you know, another thing that's kind of sad about it, too, it wasn't like he initially injured his shoulder. You know, like he was overthrown, he got off to a good start last year, and then he had tendonitis in his knee. You know, he went to AA last year, had 35 strikeouts in 18 and a third innings, and you know, building on what I saw in the spring, he only walked four guys. It's like, this guy could be in the big leagues right now. Like, I'm convinced that he'd been in the big leagues last April, he would have been able to at least hold his own. I mean, the stuff was that good. And then he came down with tendonitis in his knee. And while he was rehabbing, coming back from the tendonitis in his knee and trying to build his arm strength back up, you know, who knows if his delivery got altered a little bit or he was favoring the knee. But then he injured his shoulder trying to come back from the knee injury. And he hasn't pitched since.
Okay. Five guys dropped out and five guys were added to the list. Those on the way out, well, they're not on their way out. They're already out. Jackson Jobe, Tigers right-hander. Gordon Grisevo, Cardinals right-hander. Drew Romo, Rockies catcher. Wilmer Flores, Tigers right-hander. And Brennan Davis, who's kind of been in and out, now back out, Cubs outfield prospect. New faces in the top 100, number 95, Matt McClain, who was just called up by the Reds. Outfielder, Astros outfield prospect Drew Gilbert is number 96. Number 97, Ronnie Mauricio, he's back in the top 100. A's right-hander Mason Miller, who you saw in the big leagues, is number 98. And number 100 is Andrew Abbott, a Reds left-hander who's been absolutely outstanding so far this year. Yeah, guys, McClain and Mauricio, we see back in the top 100. Mauricio is, you know, somebody who feels like he's been around forever. He debuted in the top 100 back in the midseason of 2019 at number 84. Got as high as number 57 midseason 2000 and remained on the list until preseason of last year. And then fell out midseason last year, was not on the preseason list, but he's back in there. Why?
The power, I mean, as much as anything else, but I mean, it goes beyond that. He's always been an intriguing guy, and you're right. I double checked when we were going over this. I'm like, how is he only 22? And like, he just turned 22. He has been sort of on the radar for a while, you know, big signing back in July of 2017. The power he's been able to get to for a while now. You know, he hit 20 homers in 2021, then he hit 26 last year. He had a 2020 season. I think there's always been some concern about the approach. He doesn't walk a lot. He does strike out a fair amount, but you know, he had a really strong, and he sort of got back on my radar initially, because he had a very strong showing in the Dominican Winter League. And then he's in AAA this year again at age 22 and has been absolutely raking. Still striking out a little too much, maybe walking a little bit more, but getting to his power. He's got an OPS over 1,000. A lot of people thought that he'd never play, that he wasn't going to play shortstop. He's still there. The Mets think he has a chance now. Obviously, he's not going to play shortstop in New York, but he can play some second base. He's played a little bit of third base over the winter. You know, so far in Syracuse, he's played just short and second. But I think the fact that he's continuing to get to his power and hitting the ball more consistently this year on the heels of that 2020 season last year was reason enough for me to want to move him back onto the list.
Yeah, hitting 353 as we speak. Jim, one of these new faces you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'll go with Drew Gilbert of the Astros, who, you know, I think so far, if the draft were done today, I feel like, you know, Spencer Jones of the Yankees, who was another guy we discussed, who went 25th, and Drew Gilbert, who went 28th, would probably go higher in the draft than they did last July. And, you know, Gilbert didn't get much of a pro debut last year after signing out of Tennessee because he ran into the wall in center field and dislocated his right elbow, had a hamstring that held him back, hamstring injury held him back in spring training this year. But he's been healthy for the regular season. It took him all of 3 weeks to force a promotion from high A, where he hit 360 and had an OPS over 1,100, six homers in 21 games. He's in double A. You know, he plays with his hair, you know, everybody makes the same comment. He plays with his hair on fire, you know, borderline, like he can get a little overly emotional. He did down the stretch in the region, the super regional last year for Tennessee against Notre Dame, but he plays aggressive in all phases of the game. It's an aggressive approach, but he makes a lot of contact. He, you know, he's 5'9", but he produces a lot of power. It's probably 15 to 20 homer power, at least with that aggressive approach. Solid runner. He's aggressive on the base pass. He's aggressive in center. He's got a strong arm. My favorite factoid about Drew Gilbert is that going back to his high school days, he was a Minnesota product. He was the second best high school pitcher in the upper Midwest in 2019, behind only Quinn Priester, who went in the first round, Pirates guy. But I mean, he was up to 93. He had a pretty good slider. Really interesting guy. But I was talking to him a little bit about in spring training. He likes to play every day. So he was not cut out to be a pitcher unless you could somehow bring him out of the bullpen every day. He likes to play every day. And I think he's the type of guy who club feeds off his energy. I do think, you know, Tennessee has really struggled this year, you know, partly because they turned over their whole lineup, but the team has just not had the same, you know, chemistry maybe is an overused word at times, but I think it's appropriate with the Volunteers. They've had kind of a really up and down season playing 500 ball in the SEC. And I remember talking to Chase Dolander, their starter, who's going to be a first round pick at the beginning of the season. And he said the key to their team was going to be to find a guy who could be the emotional leader of the team like Drew Gilbert was last year. And I don't think they have. And I think the team has suffered for it. So, you know, Gilbert, it's going to be interesting too, because Dana Brown came out and said, you know, new GM of the Astros, who was the Braves scouting director last year, he said a couple times during the offseason, basically challenged Drew Gilbert, I want to see you in the big leagues quickly. Like basically that's the guy they want to be their center fielder of the future. Center fielder has been a little bit of a revolving door for them. And so I thought it was interesting that, I mean, Drew Gilbert, who played all of 10 games in the offseason, you have a new GM, and the GM was saying, you know, not challenging like he had to improve, but just like, you know, we're expecting you to get to Houston pretty quickly, which I don't think you see too many GMs say that about a guy that soon.
All right. That's a look at our updated top 100 prospects list. That thing is on MLB.com/pipeline. Check it out there. Also a nice story summarizing all of this from Sam Dykstra. Check that out as well. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will talk about some recent big league call-ups and this week's prospect team of the week. That's coming up next on the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Jason Ratliff, Jim Callis, Jonathan Mayo went over the new top 100 prospects list. A couple guys on that list were recently called up, one being Eury Pérez, one of the top pitching prospects in baseball. Marlins called him up. And as we're recording this, Matt McClain has been called up. We haven't seen him yet. He just got called up. First on Eury, he skipped AAA. Were you guys surprised that he got called up when he did? Did you think... Did you expect him to skip AAA, or did you think they were going to take him a level at a time?
I don't think it really matters in general. I mean, I think with pitchers, it's different for me than hitters. And I think in general, if you have the stuff to get guys out, like it's going to play in the big leagues. Like I think he's shown the stuff. I mean, the part that surprised me a little bit was they're using the pre-tacked ball in the Southern League, which is where he was. And I was a little surprised that maybe they didn't get him acclimated to, you know, he's never used, I guess last year he used the major league ball, but like just to get him more acclimated, you know, a start maybe without the pre-tacked ball before he got to the big leagues. Like I think the Cubs are doing that with Ben Brown a little bit right now too. But I think the reason they did it is, I mean, they have injury issues in their rotation. They have guys who haven't been effective. They're having a crazy year. I don't know if this is still true, but I know they won their first 12 one-run games. And I don't know if that streak has continued, but you know, they're hovering around 500. So they're theoretically, they lost 6-5 to the Reds. So they're now 12-1 in one-run games, but they're kind of hovering in the wild card race despite being outscored this year. So I think it was, hey, let's call him up and see what he can do. And did you guys get to watch the start? Did you take any of it in, or did you look at it after the fact?
I saw it after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, he looked good. I mean, he, you know, the fastball, like, you know, got hit a little bit when he didn't command it as well. But, I mean, he averaged 97 miles an hour with his fastball. His breaking stuff was pretty unhittable. And he was throwing an 86-mile-an-hour slider and an 81-mile-an-hour curve. And he only threw a handful of changeups, and that worked pretty well, too. But it looked really, really good. He gave up a couple home runs. And other than that, he struck out 8 in, I think, what, 4 2/3 innings. I don't think he looked overwhelmed by it at all. And I think we'll see him for a while.
4 hits, 2 of them home runs. And that kind of matches what he'd done this year at Double A. He'd given up 5 home runs. And that was out of 8, 10, 12, 14, just 16 hits overall. So yeah, when he's been hit, he's given up the long ball. But I was kind of wondering, like, how important do you guys think it is to strike while the iron is hot with these guys? Like, Yuri had been on a tear. I mean, he had been outstanding. Hadn't given up more than two hits in his past four starts, just one run or less in each of those, striking out 9, 11 over 6 and 5 innings. Like, how big of a deal do you think it is to call up a pitcher when he's rolling like that, as opposed to bringing him up when he's, you know, not many guys are going to get called up when they're struggling. Although we just talked about Bryce Miller and the fact that he was not performing well at Double A when he got called up, but curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, to that point, when I talked to the Mariners about Miller getting called up, yes, his surface numbers weren't very good, but everything underneath it, they were very happy with all the data, his stuff, that, you know, that gave him confidence that he was ready. And I think ideally, if you can get him with some wind, wind at their sails, you know, that's preferable, whatever level you're taking them from. I'm wondering if they sort of told Yuri Perez, like, we want to see you do X, Y, Z, and he did it very quickly. And so they felt, okay, you know, he's executing the things that we felt he needed to do. And so we called them up. With Jim, a little surprised that they didn't give him a little time to adjust to the different baseball. But that said, you know, his combination of stuff and feel for the strike zone and command is not typical. And so I think that helped them feel more confidence in having someone that young make that double jump up to the big leagues.
Yeah, I mean, when you have a mid-80s slider that's your third best pitch and you throw a ton of strikes and you're deceptive, that's going to play. So yeah. I think they felt pretty good about calling him up. And Jason, I do think your point's a good one. I mean, yes, you generally aren't going to get called up if you're struggling, but I think calling up a guy when he's on a roll, it just fills him with more confidence. Because I do think this will oversimplify things a little bit. The biggest struggle that rookies have when they break into the big leagues is a lot of times they think that they have to do more to succeed rather than keep doing what got them there. And so if you have a guy who's on a roll like Yuri Perez was in this case, yeah, you could call up and really say, just keep doing what you're doing. You're going to be fine. And it was pretty spectacular. I think he struck out, eight out of the 20 batters he faced.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
All right. And the other recent call-up from the top 100 prospects list, Reds infield prospect Matt McClain, first rounder, number 17 overall, just 2 years ago in 2021. One of a glut of middle infield prospects that the Reds have on the way, and a lot of them pretty near. Obviously a lot of people watching LA De La Cruz and what he's doing. They also, their second ranked prospect is another shortstop slash third baseman, Noel V. Marte. Their third ranked prospect is another shortstop, Edwin Arroyo. So they are loaded at that position, and McClain, first one up here. He's a guy who, you know, we saw him somewhat similar to Ronnie Mauricio, we talked about earlier, who'd been in the top 100 prospects list for a while. McClain jumped right in there after being drafted at number 99 in midseason of 2021, moved up to 87 preseason 2022, up to 76 midseason 2022. Had fallen out entering this year, but he has been fantastic.
Yeah, he's been really good. And you forgot the most important thing, friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod, that is.
Friend of the pod. So, yeah, I think when the Reds drafted McLean out of UCLA, they thought he could move quickly, and they are not afraid to push their college bats, and they sent him to AA right away last year, and he struggled. There were some good things. He hit for a decent amount of power with 17 homers, and he stole 27 bases, but he kind of sold out for that power way too much, so his strikeout rate really ballooned. He still drew walks, but he struck out of like 29% of his plate appearances last year, and that led to his struggles. Then he went to the Arizona Fall League, and I think he was just out of gas after his first full season and really did not perform well there. And that's why we nudged him off of the top 100. I thought maybe the Reds would send him back to AA. Some of has to do with making sure that all those middle infielders you talked about have at-bats at various levels. But some of it also had to do with their confidence in his ability to make adjustments, the makeup that he has. This is a guy who kind of has that, grinder, baseball rat kind of vibe. And he can really, really hit. And he clearly learned from last year. The strikeout rate is down. His miss rate is down. He's still hitting the ball hard all the time. I wrote, in an analysis piece today that he already had 29 balls 100 miles an hour or harder off the bat in just 38 AAA games. So, the walk rate is still super high. He's almost walked as much as he struck out. And he was among the minor league leaders in like every offensive category imaginable. So he's hitting for average. He's hitting, the power is still there. I think the jury's still out whether or not he can play shortstop every day, in perpetuity, but he's going to play shortstop now. The shortstops in Cincinnati, Jose Barrero and Kevin Newman have not been hitting. He's not the defender Barrero is, but he's fine. He makes the plays that are hit to him, and he's definitely an offensive upgrade over both of them. So he'll play short. He can slide over to second when they need him to, if, Jonathan India needs a day off. Not that Barrero or Newman can't do that also, but I think he has a real good chance to stick and hit for a very long time.
All right. Let's talk prospect team of the week now. We each week highlight prospects who are on their team's top 30 prospects list who have had the best weeks, put a team together. This week's team goes like this: catcher Dalton Rushing of the Dodgers, first base Ivan Melendez of the D-backs, along with fellow D-backs infield prospect Ryan Bliss at second base. On the left side of the infield, we've talked about them. Ellie De La Cruz and Matt McClain had huge weeks. Outfield, Rockies prospect Yankiel Fernandez, James Wood of the Nats, Colton Cowser of the Orioles, left-handed pitcher Parker Messick of the Guardians, Brian Wu of the Mariners, and Austin Bergner of the Tigers is the relief pitcher. Jonathan, Colton Cowser, Matt McClain has put up some ridiculous numbers at AAA. Colton Cowser has as well.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe it's because the Orioles system is so deep and they've had, the high end guys like, Adley Rutschman and, Gunnar Henderson, Grayson Rodriguez on the mound, Heston Kerstad, the incredible comeback story. He's not gotten that much attention. Another guy that they took, ahead of industry consensus when they took him number 5 overall in 2021. Last year he did strike out a ton, but he hit his way up to AAA and had 19 homers and 18 steals. Hit well in A ball and AA, struggled in AAA. So back in AAA now, as you pointed out, the OPS is over 1,000. The strikeouts are down, the walks are still very much up, and he's coming off of another really, really good week in AAA, where he had multiple hit games repeatedly, two homer game on May 11th. He's power and speed. I don't know where they put him. But the door knocking is starting to get a little bit louder, and in a lot of ways he's not gotten the attention he might have gotten if he were in a less deep system.
Jim, tell us about somebody who intrigues you on this prospect team of the week?
Yeah, it would be Parker Messick of the Guardians. I did not lose $25,000 there. Left-hander they took in the second round of last year's draft. And he's kind of your classic Guardians polished pitcher. His velocity has not made a huge jump yet or anything like that. But he's kind of the typical Guardians MO of guys that like taking the draft, guys who have great feel for pitching, throw a lot of strikes. I think his two best attributes are probably his command. He's got a low 80s changeup with a ton of tumble. That's a well above average pitch in the mind of some scouts. That changeup, and also he's got kind of a flat approach angle, help his low 90s fastball play up. His breaking balls are more pitches he throws for strikes, and they're really going to miss bats. But I know that the Guardians were very excited about him. He comes with a high floor to begin with, but in terms of their, I guess, onboarding process is a way to describe it, the things they kind of want pitchers who are coming into their system out of the draft to, ways they can help make guys get better. He really took to that. So last offseason, he hadn't even made his pro debut last year. He's making it now. They said, look, this guy could move pretty quickly. He is what we thought he was, and we're very encouraged by the strides he's making, even though you're not seeing it in games. And he's off to, not just this last week, but through six starts in single A. He's got a 1.13 ERA, 27 strikeouts, and 24 innings. Frankly, they probably need to promote him pretty soon, because a guy like Parker Messick, coming out of Florida State and the ACC, with his advanced feel for pitching and that changeup, which is a weapon, those guys more often than not destroy single A hitters. I mean, you have guys who are jumping up from the complex leagues who've never seen a changeup like that. And so I it'll be a better test when he gets to high A, but I do think he's the type of guy we might see him in double A by the end of the year. And he can move very quickly in that Cleveland system.
Yeah. I would say a 1.13 ERA and 198 average against probably qualifies as destroying. All right. We have some draft buzz to talk about. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to do that and answer a question from the mailbag coming up next on the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Jim Callis over there, Jonathan Mayo over there. I'm Jason Ratliff right here, pointing in the general direction of Chicago. I was going to say Pittsburgh, but I think, Jonathan, you're in North Carolina.
Are you aligned properly? Do you actually know what direction Chicago's in, or are you just...
Nah, I'm physically pointing, but just left and down and to my right. As though I'm standing on the map.
I guess your arms should be at a right angle to each other.
I get a very Schoolhouse Rock image in my head of you, like an animated Jason Ratliff standing on a map pointing in different directions.
I have no idea what direction I'm facing here.
Okay. Forward.
So, yeah, I am facing forward. Draft buzz. Let's talk some draft buzz. What is going on? What do we need to know?
Well, first, before Jonathan launches in, I want to know Jonathan's beginning work on his new mock. His first mock since the season started. Can you tease us, Jonathan? You got a little, anything new at the top? Anything interesting in the top 10?
No, nothing. Nothing as of yet. I think the top five are going to be the same names as of right now. You know, I think everyone is expecting, not everyone, the people are expecting that there's invariably one name that floats into that top five that you're not expecting to push one of those other top fives into the 6 to 10 range. At least the teams that are picking 6 to 10 are hoping that.
I think that's more wishful thinking.
It often happens. Kumar Rocker last year, right? So I think, we may not know who that player is for some time now. It's pretty early.
Okay, a question for you, and then I know I'm hijacking our podcast. I'm sorry. Based on right now, good move. Mistake if you deviate from the top five players in the top five picks. I think it would be
a mistake. I agree. I would agree with you.
I mean, you guys have those five locked in and separated.
Not just us.
Everybody.
It's so funny. Like Jonathan said, you talk to the teams that are picking 6 to 10, and they're all like, oh, can Max Clark get to us? Could so? Right. Yeah, but I was talking to a team that picks toward the end of top 10. And then they were talking about like who possibly could go ahead to push guys down to us.
No, so. It would have to be like someone cutting a deal or something like that. Right. I mean, and that's, you know, I don't think that that is clear. That's not going to be clear for some time. And as of right now, I just don't, I don't see that happening. So the, those five names and, you know, very quickly, Dylan Cruz, Paul Skeens from LSU, Wyatt Langford from Florida, Walker Jenkins, a high school outfielder from North Carolina, Max Clark, a prep outfielder from Indiana. Those are the top five. I'm pretty secure in saying that that will be the top five in some order when I file this mock later this week.
All right. Well, tell us about some names that are on the rise. Maybe not rising into
top five.
The top five.
Well, I think it's interesting. The one name, and Jim mentioned him in his mock, his last mock, that's sort of interesting is a high school arm in Alex Clemmie, who's from Rhode Island. And his name is being mentioned as a potential first rounder. And, you know, he's got unbelievable stuff, and he's a lefty. But the command isn't very good. And I don't know if it's just the things, you know, warming up in New England and he's been pitching better and better. But, so that's the sort of like, wow, that's a name that, normally you do not hear high school arms moving up. But there's, there's a lack of lefties and we may get to that in a second. But typically what does happen are college bats move up. Not necessarily this early, but there are a number of guys who are performing well whose names are moving up into the first round. Tommy Troy from Stanford, Yohandy Morales from Miami, both guys who have been in first round conversations for a while. Yohandy Morales, I think Jim and I both, when we were like putting the 150 together, people were kind of down on him and we didn't totally understand why. He's not super athletic, but he's now hitting over 400 with an ops of 1120 something, playing for Miami in the ACC. So he's moving up. And then Chase Davis is an interesting name at Arizona because he's a guy who's always had tools. He's always had raw power, but the swing and miss was always a concern. He's walked more than he struck out this year. The strikeout rate is way down. So all the other numbers are way up. And I had someone today say that they've heard his name as high as in the middle of the first round. So it wouldn't surprise me if you saw Chase Davis's name in my mock come the end of the week.
And Jonathan, I want to ask you, in terms of guys moving up, a guy who I keep thinking, when I talk to those teams who are picking 6 to 10 and they're kind of trying to figure out like who exactly should go 6 to 10, I had Kyle Teal, the Virginia catcher, who we know is a good defensive player. He's having a really nice offensive year after kind of a down sophomore season. I had him going 13th to the Cubs. I'm almost wondering, like, do you think he could go in the top 10? Are you hearing any buzz as you work on this mock?
Yeah, I didn't mention him, Jim, because I know that you as you've said, you put him in pretty high in the mock. I've heard his name being like a top 10 caliber player. I've heard from national scouts who say like, oh, there's no way he makes it out of the top 10. I'm just, in the very early stages of working on this week's mock. So I don't have like, oh yes, Kyle Teal's going to be in the top 10, but it wouldn't surprise me if he landed in the net 6 to 10 range. As we pointed out, I think if the top five stays the top five, then 6 through 10 is an incredible flux. There's not a set of five names that like, they're definitely going to go there. So if there's not a guy that you really, really love, and maybe Kyle Teal you wouldn't have at the top of your list when you're picking 7, 8, 9 or whatever, maybe you go and take the guy who's done it at Virginia and can catch.
All right, Jim, and Jonathan had alluded to the dearth of lefties.
Yeah, it's interesting. I keep looking for lefties to move up the boards. Teams always want left-handed pitching. And, you mentioned Alex Clemmie, Jonathan, who's a high school kid. With Thomas White, I think, is the top lefty. And there's some high school names, Cameron Johnson, Paul Wilson's another one. But, man, on the college side, you know, Hunter Owen is back. You know, we talked about him when we did the new list, how he was sidelined. He's back, but he's kind of an enigma. Grayson Hitz had Tommy John surgery at Alabama. Hunter Owens at Vanderbilt. Jaden Woods at Georgia hasn't pitched in about 4 or 5 weeks. They're going to try to bring him back against LSU. You know, maybe the best lefty is Sean Sullivan at Wake Forest, who he throws like an 88 to 92 mile an hour fastball about 75% of the time and guys don't hit it. But like, I cannot remember a draft like this, Jonathan, where there's just no college lefties with a clean bill of health and like quality stuff. Like it's hard to find college lefties put in the first couple rounds. And you'll see this when you do the mock, just college pitchers as a whole. You know, you mentioned Skeens, who's going to be the first one taken. And you got Chase Dolander and Rhett Lauder and Hurston Waldrop are three more college pitchers, all right-handers. And then after that, it's hard to find pitchers to not just go in the first round, but who you feel are even like a slam dunk, I think, top two rounds guy. And I know from talking to scouts as we are working on our upcoming draft 200 as we expand it and move guys around, there are not more names emerging out of the woodwork. There are not pop-up college pitchers who are going to go in the first two or three rounds. It's pretty barren. There have been injuries this year, not as many as last year, but it's just there's so few guys healthy or having good years.
Yeah, it's been disappointing because I think we headed into this year thinking, even at the start of the year, like, oh, maybe it'll be better compared to last year because the injuries just ravaged last year, and that just hasn't really been the case outside of the top, you know, top name or two.
There is one college left-hander in the top how many prospects on our top 150 list right now? Do you know? Guess. Pipeline pop quiz.
I think it's like top 80.
I was going to say 75.
Yeah, 82. And only three in the top 100.
So, one of whom's had Tommy John surgery.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Tim Sherry would like to ask a question. Has done so here in the mailbag. This is from Sherry Storm 22. Looking at their stats the last few years, it would appear Ellie De La Cruz is a superior prospect to Jordan Walker. What elevates Walker over Cruz in your he does call him Cruz in your projections?
Why don't I start with the how you could make that argument, even though I don't totally agree with it. And I love Ellie De La Cruz. We all love Ellie De La Cruz. And his ceiling is extraordinary. I think the argument can be made in that De La Cruz had, a higher OPS last year than Jordan Walker. You know, he was 20-40. The Statcast numbers are insane. He's maybe a slightly more dynamic prospect than Jordan Walker in terms of those numbers. However, and Jim, I'll let you take it from here.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that's all fair. I mean, I think you can make an argument that Ellie De La Cruz is the most electrifying prospect in the minors. But for me, when you're trying to separate the guys, and like I said, I think, what, Jonathan, you, me, and Sam all voted Ellie De La Cruz in our top four when we were voting for the top 100, and we all had Jordan Walker in the top two. So it's not a big, big difference. But I just feel more confident in Walker's bat. I mean, I think Ellie De La Cruz, I mean, Walker's a good athlete for his size. I think Ellie De La Cruz is a better athlete and has more defensive value than Jordan Walker. But I feel more comfortable with Jordan Walker hitting. I think he's a better hitter. I think he makes more consistent contact. I think he controls the strike zone better. And I think their raw power is comparable, but I feel better about Jordan Walker getting to more power in games. I mean, again, we're nitpicking about, the number one prospect versus number four prospect in all of baseball. But I just feel more comfortable with Jordan Walker's bat. So that's why I would put Jordan Walker ahead of Ellie De La Cruz.
Yeah, I think that's
how
fair.
How about you? Does that sum up why?
Would it shock any of us if somehow Ellie De La Cruz was a better, I don't even want to be better, but like does more exciting things in the big leagues than Jordan Walker? No, I don't think it's like that far fetched to imagine that happening. But I think it is there's more confidence that Jordan Walker is going to reach his ceiling, and the strikeout rate and the lack of pitch selection, plate discipline from Eli De La Cruz makes us pause just enough for him not to be ahead of Jordan Walker, you know, or the other guys.
I mean, if you want to, like, I don't, if you wanted to put Eli De La Cruz ahead of him, that's fine. I don't necessarily think that the stats show that, that he's better, but I think you, you could make that argument. I mean, and defend it like you did, Jonathan.
Yep.
Very easily, I think. I mean, there's no more, like, I have him slightly ahead of Jackson Churio in terms of the most electrifying prospect in the minors. Like, I think he's the most exciting guy
yep.
to watch anywhere in the minor leagues. Is that, because you never know what he's going to do on a given day.
All right. Thanks to Tim Sherry for that question. And thanks to everybody out there for listening. That's going to do it for this week's episode of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.